The psalm begins with a question. Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell in your holy hill? And then it gives us an answer that begins, those who walk blamelessly. I remember when I was a seminary student in Vancouver, I lived in a community house that was a group of us that were all interested in conversation about God. I'd put an ad on Craigslist advertising for anyone to live in this house of a few bedrooms. Anyone from any religious background who wanted to come together and together learn and converse about who God is. And one of the guys that lived in this house was a man who was in his mid-40s, who was actually from Detroit, Michigan. And he was very interested in kind of Eastern meditation and Eastern religions. It was interesting, whenever I would invite him to come to church, he would always respond with this attitude of, you know, he'd be interested, but he'd also be holding back. And I remember him once saying, when I invited him to church, he said, "I'm not a good enough person to go to church. I don't belong there." And I remember just hearing this and responding and saying, "Craig, you don't understand. The whole idea of church, the whole point of church, is that none of us deserve to be in God's presence. God welcomes all of us, and you're never going to be good enough on your own. Just come, and God will meet you there." But then it's interesting to come across a psalm like Psalm 15, which at first read almost seems to support a more legalistic reading of who is it that is worthy to be in God's presence. Those who walk blamelessly is the psalm's answer. But as we look closer at Psalm 15, we see that the list of virtues that's described in it, that describe the one who's deemed fitting for the presence of the Lord, is not a list of conditions meant to exclude people from worship. Psalm 15, rather, presents us with a description of the nature of the God in whose presence we come and the good life that he invites us into. And so the key to understanding this psalm and reading it right is, as the Old Testament scholar James Mays says, we are to read it as a liturgy and not as law. In Mays' words, it is not intended to exclude the unqualified. Rather, it is the rehearsal of a purpose and a possibility. I'll say that again. It is not intended to exclude the unqualified. Rather, it is the rehearsal of a purpose and a possibility. So this evening, as we sit under this psalm, we'll come to it with the hope of three things happening. One, the rehearsal of God's purpose for us. Two, the rehearsal of God's possibility in us. And three, this is my own additions to Mays' first two, the rehearsal of God's promise to us. In reciting Psalm 15, we rehearse God's purpose for us. Psalm 15 shows us the kind of person, and really the kind of world, that the presence of God intends. It shows us a person who is good. It shows us relationships that are good. It shows us a whole social order, social practices that are good. Psalm 15 shows us that God intends good for the world. And this, of course, is not a truth that is easily accepted by everyone. I remember listening to a podcast, the show Radiolab, if some of you know that show. And it's usually conversations about topics in science. And I was listening to an interview by the famous atheist Richard Dawkins. And Dawkins was talking about what he sees to be the overwhelming empirical evidence of inestimable suffering in the world. He says his whole experience of the world and studying the ways that animals relate to each other, the whole idea of the evolutionary process, he says the world is just full of violence and death and evil. And he says quite strongly he sees no reason to believe that there's a good God actively, intentionally making good in the world. Now that's from an atheist, and yet even us Christians may at times wonder about the goodness of God. I remember one Sunday morning when we were in here, and it was just when the flooding in Pakistan had begun, and we were praying, I mean the whole church together praying for the rains to stop in Pakistan, just this unrelenting flooding that was displacing thousands and thousands of people. And I remember thinking as we were praying, you know, pleading for God to stop this rain, and then seeing in the days following that rain would continue. I remember, you know, thinking that sometimes, even as Christians, we can look around at the state of the world, and it may not even be clear to us that God is truly out to save us and not to destroy us. But then we look at the picture that Psalm 15 paints of God's intention for his world. Imagine this world of Psalm 15, the world in which people walk together blamelessly, acting towards one another in a way that is right, speaking truth, committing no evil against one another, standing by their oaths even to their hurt, having nothing to do with practices that exploit the poor and the weak, like lending money at high interest or taking bribes against the innocent. A world where people are called to despise only that which threatens life. The psalm shows us that our God is good. His purpose for this world, his purpose for you, is good. And then we come to point number two, that in reciting Psalm 15, we rehearse God's possibility in us. In May's words again, the biblical scholar says, "This kind of person, says the psalm, is what the presence of God intends. This presence, says the psalm, is the power that makes this kind of person possible." Psalm 15 directs us to the one who is the source of all hope for a transformed world. Examine yourself when you come into this one's presence. This is what the psalm is asking the reader to do. Examine yourself. Famous Old Testament scholar Hermann Gunkel used to refer to passages like Psalm 15 as an entrance liturgy, was the term used. A liturgy that is used in Israel's formal worship, perhaps upon the arrival of pilgrims at the gates of the sanctuary for participation in one of Israel's festivals. And so you see in the psalm that there's basically three parts to it. And you can imagine this liturgy being played out in Israel's worship. The pilgrim comes to the gates of the temple, and the question is posed, "Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill?" And then there's that second section, which is the response, which gives us this description of the character of the person who is fitting. And then there's the third part, which is the response, the promise, which we'll talk about in a second. And so there's this examination process that's happening through these phases. And again, the intention of the pilgrim stopping to examine themselves before the entrance into worship was not intended to scare them away, but rather it was intended to prepare their lives for the transforming power of the presence that they were about to enter. With God, worship is always necessarily entangled with lifestyle. We begin in this psalm to hear the mantra of the prophets, telling us that worship and life must always go hand in hand. Temple and conduct always come together. A holy place requires a holy people. And this is precisely because the one whose purpose for us is good is the one who is himself at the heart good. And the good that he is spills over into the good that we ourselves come to possess simply by being near him. The image that comes to mind for me is an ice cube in the presence of heat, being melted, being absorbed by its nearness to this source of heat. Or a biblical image, the faith of the woman who comes to Jesus and reaches in the crowd just to touch his cloak, believing that simply to be in his presence is to be transformed and changed. May says again, the presence calls and commands, judges and redeems. To be in the place of the presence means to be at the point where the purpose and power of God come to bear on a person's identity and formation. In reciting Psalm 15, we thirdly rehearse God's promise to us. The psalm ends with a single line in response to the description of the one in God's presence. And it's a line that closes with a promise. Those who do these things shall never be moved. In the presence of God, we find the place that we can finally call our permanent home. It's interesting, if you look at the language used, if we go back up to the first verse, the language used in this question, Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? It brings to mind the images of the resident aliens who lived among Israel. The resident alien was the outsider that was permitted to live along with those to whom tents and territories belonged. Who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? And the resident alien, of course, has no inherent right to be there. The privilege for them to stay has to be granted. But then in this psalm, through this direct address to the Lord, privilege from God is granted. Those who do these things shall never be moved. And God's invitation isn't just an invitation to come and visit for a while, pay your respects and move on. No, God's invitation is an invitation to come, to stay, and to never be moved again. It is an invitation home, finally, at last, forever. And how can this be? Well, 1 Corinthians 1:30 tells us that God has made Jesus Christ our righteousness. In Jesus Christ, we become the qualified ones who can stand in the presence of God and be at home. As we are baptized into his new life, reborn into his family, he sets us atop a new foundation, one which cannot be shaken. Thinking of this imagery of being unmovable or unshakable, as some of the translations have it, brought to mind some of the things I've been reading in the news lately about President Mubarak in Egypt. If you've been keeping up with the news, you've seen the last 5 or 6 days these incredible protests in the country of Egypt, which are really, it seems, pushing over the leadership and and shaking the government of Egypt. And this president, Mubarak, who has been ruling Egypt with iron fist for over 30 years now. And I was reading some of the biography about this president, and over again, I kept describing him as, you know, a military man, someone whose life is ordered and disciplined. You know, he's known to get up very early every morning and play racquetball. He's 82 years old, but he's in incredible health. He eats well. His whole life is controlled and disciplined. And he's ruled his country for 30 years with that same sort of control and discipline. And even though a figure like him, who's perhaps one of the most fixed leaders in the world for so long, who's ruled almost as long as any other president in the world, to see the carpet being pulled out from underneath him, to see his control, his authority, his rule being shaken and tumbling down like this, is such a reminder of how shakable and movable our whole world is. I think of that image and I contrast it with an article in Time magazine. I remember when Time magazine came out with its New Year's article right around Y2K, when it was the year 2000. The question that the magazine had posed was, who is the most influential person of the last 1,000 years? And they went over a number of possible people, of course, Adolf Hitler or Martin Luther, significant figures in world history over the last 1,000 years. And interestingly, the people at Time magazine decided that the most influential person from the years 1000 to 2000 was Jesus Christ. Even though Jesus, of course, had walked the earth even 1,000 years before then, his authority, his rule in the creation was still more influential than any of the greatest of the greats in human history. An Old Testament scholar, Dr. Craigie, says the only possibility of transforming lament into confidence or praise lay in the fact that there is an unshakable position transcending the vicissitudes of a shaken and uncertain life. That position is in the presence of God. And this is the one with whom we will stand forever, unmoved. This is the God who holds us fast.